Welcome to another episode of LFC Talk at Hotel Tia, this time a Shankly special. It is 108 years since the great man got born this month, and with us we have his very own granddaughter and an author of his book as well, Karen Gill. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you.
When September 2nd comes around, how do you then feel? What comes up into your mind then? And what happens that day for you?
It's always a bit of an experience, to be honest, because, you know, through social media, I get contacted by so many people, so many supporters and really lovely messages and people telling me about their experiences with him and their memories of him. So it's a real, it's a really lovely day to honour his memory. I always actually, at one point it was quite, you know, a few years ago, it would get very, very, very emotional. Now I just see it as a positive thing because it's a way of remembering him and from lots of different people's perspectives. So, yeah, it can be a bit emotional, but it's also just a great way to honour his memory.
I was fortunate enough to do a walk with you on the day of the anniversary, and a journalist called. And you said something that really burned into my memory in terms of how you described him as a lighthouse in terms of how we should remember fans' importance. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's what I see. He's like my go-to. Like, if I want to think about, like, what's important and remember what's important, I'll remember his ethics and his ideas, his way of thinking about the supporters, and that they were everything. You know, you whatever you do with the players, he would always say to them, you know, whatever you do, it's for them. And I mean, he embodied that in so many different ways. He you know, if supporters had a problem with tickets or train tickets or whatever, he would try to help them. And at the end of the day, that's what we saw with COVID. We saw the situation when there were no supporters in the stadium, that it was, you know, it wasn't the same thing. And he realised how important they were to the game. And I think it's good to remember, yeah, he is like a lighthouse. Go back, what would he have said? What would he have done? It's a good way to, it's a yardstick for me, like, to do the right thing, I think.
And now you are in Hotel Tia working with the fans every week. What has that been like to now be as close to the fans, almost not as close as your granddad, obviously, but still in that environment as a workplace?
Yeah, it's been really lovely, and especially because I've had the chance to speak to some great players as well, and to share memories with them, and they've been telling me about their stories and what they remember about him. And especially with David Fairclough, that was really nice. I think, you know, he got the tail end of the very last year of my granddad's year in football. And it was just nice to see how much he respected him and still held him in such high esteem. So it's great. And to be able to share stories with people coming in and out and get a few pictures with people, it's just really nice.
Bill Shankly came to the club in 1959. He spent 14, almost 15 seasons as the Liverpool manager, and he absolutely made a revolution to our football club. He won the league 3 times. He got us up in the first division where we belonged. We won it quite quickly, and already in 63 we won the league. And then he also made Liverpool win the FA Cup for the very first time in 65. He broke so many grounds with the club. And when you walk to the ground and you come to the main entrance of Liverpool, the first one to greet you is actually your granddad on the statue in front of the cup, saying he made the people happy. What do you think when you see that statue?
Yeah, I mean, especially now that I'm working in Tia, I get the chance to walk past there a few times a week. And it's just every time, it kind of almost moves me to tears every time. And the other day I was walking past there, and some people had come for the tour, the stadium tour, and watching them walk past his statue and touch the statue as they were walking past, it was like a little ritual, you know, and a sign of respect to him as well. And it just made me well up with tears, to be honest. So many years later, so much respect from the supporters, the people he loved. It just seems like a great connection still. That connection is still there. So very emotional every time I see him.
And the supporter group at the COP is even called the Spirit of Shankly,
mm-hmm.
Where you are the patron. How does that make you feel that the, let's, I don't know about the expression, the hardcore fans, but, you know, the passionate fans, the core of the club's fans base, actually honour him in the name of their group?
Well, it's like I said before. I mean, I think they do look to him as the lighthouse as well. They're, you know, the beacon, the yardstick, the person they go to who embodies their ideals and the way they think about football, the way they see football. And Spirit of Shankly does so much to keep his legend alive, to keep his memory alive in such a positive way, in a way that is fitting. In my opinion, it's fitting. And I'm just very proud, and I'm really proud of all the work they do in trying to keep his memory alive in such an appropriate way.
What's the most important things that the Spirit of Shankly do for the fans?
Well, they do. I mean, especially now in COVID, they did so much to make sure that, you know, people were getting food parcels. You know, they are very much involved in the community as well. So they make sure that people had medication, they had food. So it's more than just the supporters who get to the match. You know, they are involved in the community. The food banks, the fan supports food banks, they're very much involved in that, and other projects that will make sure that the people are in and around Anfield also, you know, are, you know, if they're struggling, that there is a helping hand there. So apart from all the stuff of holding the club to account, which is also so important, especially now with COVID, when maybe things will try to be pushed through, you know, things that maybe don't really benefit the supporters 100%. It's really important to have that accountability, and so that's exactly what Spirit of Shankly there to do, to hold them accountable.
Let's go back to your granddad, the great Bill Shankly. What was he like as a granddad?
Well, you know, he was very much what you see was what you got. So many people have told me, and it is true, that if when he came into a room, there was kind of a charisma, an aura around him, people would stop speaking. Their gaze would automatically go to him. And that can be very, especially when you're young, that can be a little bit, intimidating. He was an intimidating man. He wasn't a man of many, many words. And even when he was at home and he was relaxed, he was still basically the same person. He was obsessed with football, even at home. It was all about talking about football on the phone or watching football matches on the TV or filling in his football coupons. We absolutely adored him. We loved going with him everywhere. You know, if he took us to the barber shop on Eaton Road, we would sit on his knee. If he would take us for ice cream in a little place called Capaldi's, I can't even remember exactly where that is, but that was a treat. He would take us there, even though we would be surrounded by supporters, and it wasn't always great. It was just nice to be with him. You know, and when he laughed, if you made him laugh, you always felt very special.
And people would come to his house all the time, wouldn't they?
Yep.
And everyone would be welcomed in?
Absolutely. I mean, my grandmother as well would make pots of tea, or she'd give orange juice and biscuits to people if they had to wait for a while. Or she would invite people in as well to have a cup of coffee. I mean, I even know some Greek supporters who travelled all the way from Greece, and they went to, it was like their Mecca, they said. And they went to see, this was after my granddad had died, but they wanted to see my nan, and she invited them in and she gave them biscuits and tea even after he'd passed away. So she'd kept up that tradition a little bit. We always, when we sat down to eat on a Sunday, if we were going to have our Sunday lunch or whatever, you know that the doorbell would always ring and he would always go and answer the door. Yeah.
And then you have these lovely memories about this typewriter, because he would answer his all his own fan mail as well.
Yeah. So he would bang away, because he was a very heavy-handed person. So he would pull the handbrake off cars very easily. He broke many cars just by the sheer force.
You make it sound like a normal thing. I don't think I've ever heard about it before.
It was for us. We were like, oh, he's probably pulled the handbrake off again. Yeah, he has. We knew that. When he was on the typewriter, he would bang away at the... I mean, you could hear it around the whole house, you know. You'd know that he was on the typewriter. You would know. And he could only do one finger, so it took him quite some time. And there would often be swearing, and if he got some things wrong and things like that, yeah.
But he still
did it.
Wrote hours and hours a week to all the fans.
Yeah.
Himself.
Religiously, yeah.
Why?
Because that was Liverpool football. That was not just... I mean, he started that kind of connection with supporters even before he went to Liverpool. Apparently, you know, he would take out the loudspeaker, for example, in Carlisle or, or Huddersfield, and the tannoy. He would speak to the fans directly. And so I suppose when he came to Liverpool, and that wasn't possible perhaps, then he would respond to the letters that they sent him.
Imagine how many letters there are out there that people treasure daily now.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I often get people saying, oh, I've just found this letter, and they are incredible, and they're so personal. It's not just like a generic email, a generic letter that, you know, it was just a standard response. Each one was very personal. Very, very personal.
Amazing.
Mm-hmm.
When you look back at all your years with him, what do you think you've learned the most from him as a person? What have you brought with you in life?
I think his determination is something that really inspires me. He's like, he never gave up. And even when things were really, really, really difficult, he just kept going. He had a vision in his mind, and that's what he was going to achieve. I think that's really inspirational and especially, I mean, he started Liverpool, you know, he was probably about 49 years old or 50. And to then achieve all of that in the middle of your life, obviously he was a footballer, and then he did some stints, obviously, with other clubs as a manager, but to achieve that kind of legendary status in the middle of your life, and, you know, to keep going and work hard all the time, I think it's really important. And to talk to everyone, include everybody. Everybody's important. The tea lady is important. We were always taught that, you know. The groundsman is important. You are polite and you talk to them. You talk to everybody. You don't ignore anybody, because they all have a part to play in the club. So, yeah.
It's a nice thing to bring with you in life. Mm. When you look back at him as a manager, as we've already mentioned, he was really, really successful. What do you think was the core reason for being so successful, and, as you say, in the middle of his life?
I think it was the perfect marriage when he came to Liverpool. You know, it's like it's serendipity a little bit. Everything came into place. Everything, like the jigsaw puzzle, suddenly started to move. Everything, all the bits that were needed came into place at the right time. It couldn't have happened any other year. Perhaps if he'd gone earlier, in 1951, maybe the same thing wouldn't have happened. You know, you had it was just the right time. It was the right time. And I do believe in that. I believe that things happen, things fall into place and they happen. And of course, when you've got a man with a vision like his, and a place like Liverpool where the supporters are so passionate and they live for football, that's a perfect, perfect marriage. And then somebody who's so determined his ethics, you know, his sense of community, that we all work together, all of those things, I think, are what made Liverpool successful.
But he must also have been a very convincing man. I mean, he managed to get Ian St. John, who was super expensive at the time, as his striker, and he managed to convince the board to get Ron Yates on board, who became, you know, the most loyal captain, the second longest serving in Liverpool's history. And on top of that, he convinced the board and the owners to make Anfield and Melwood a much higher standard. They had to spend a lot of money when your granddad came in to really sort of raise the quality and the standards for the players and the fans.
Yeah, and I think he threatened to leave quite a few times because it wasn't happening as quickly as he wanted in the beginning. So I think it was when Sawyer came in. And I think that's when he had as kind of somebody who could help to put his vision into practice, because he was probably getting very frustrated by this time. He knew that they had to spend money. He wasn't perhaps capable of convincing them on his own that they needed to do that. The board needed to be told by a third party that you need to give Bill the money that he wants, so that he, because he's got a vision and he needs money in order to, he doesn't want to just be average, he wanted to be so much more than that.
He only wrote one book himself because he was so busy writing letters to the fans and raising both the standard of the game and the facilities of Liverpool Football Club. I helped with the Norwegian version of his book when it was 100 years since he was born. And it's just amazing to see how he thought about so many details. Mm-hmm. You know, things like, one of my favorite things is how he made the home dressing room door more narrow than the away dressing room door in Anfield. Just so, and he also always made the away team wait. So when the first team of Liverpool came through that little door, they looked a lot bigger.
Yeah.
I just love that. It's just like little details that are just so clever.
Yeah. And he would all, I mean, this is all the psychology, isn't it? You build up your players. And so even though perhaps he knew that they would be playing against formidable opponents, he would, you know, as the opposition were walking, you know, past, he'd go, oh gosh, he looked really sick today. They've been on the drink the night before. You'll roll right over them. It was all psychology.
Yeah.
And then at the, you know, after a match, he would often say, well done, because they were fantastic opponents, the best quality, you know, really good. And obviously the players, but you said they look really, yeah, but it was all about the psychology. That's exactly what he was about, the psychology, building people up to believe that they could do it.
And like the sign, this is Anfield, red warning.
Yep.
So exactly. White on red, and it's still there to this day, just a pimped up version of it.
Yeah.
But it's still his. Brilliant football brain working in the tunnel even today. What about the boot room? Because he did something that was very popular in Liverpool, because he kept the staff that was already there. So Paisley and Fagan and a lot. They got to stay on when he came on board. What do you think that, what sort of effect do you think that had on the club?
Well, I think that was perhaps he found like-minded spirits, and he recognized straight away, okay, the ground is not great, Melwood is a shed, the players might be a little bit worn down and maybe even less than average, but he found in Joe and Bob and Ruben, and he found people who he probably thought, well, I can work with these men, we can do something with these men. And that was the catalyst. That was what changed everything. He couldn't have done it single-handedly. He needed people around him.
And by doing that, it secured some sort of identity and anchoring in the club as well. You know, you got the core of the club still with you. So it didn't turn all the stones and totally lose the identity of the football club.
No. I mean, he kept the people who he knew would be, he could work with, and they could achieve something.
And did they achieve something?
Well, did they? That's a obviously a rhetorical question. They certainly did.
They certainly did.
They certainly did.
First, they won the second division, obviously, before they then got into a first division, which is the top division today, obviously, guys, for the younger ones. And then he won it, you know, within so few years of climbing that ladder. And then he created absolute hysterical joy winning the FA Cup in 65.
Hmm.
The pictures.
They're incredible. They're absolutely amazing. I never tire of looking at them. And actually, when I wrote my book, I with the Liverpool Echo, we discovered new photographs I'd never seen before and that had never been published before. And they just showed the extent of people's... they were deliriously happy.
Yeah.
And people were putting themselves in danger, their lives in danger, hanging from windows and lampposts and people fainting. And it was it was like a hysteria.
But it must have been like 500,000 people in the city centre.
I think so,
It was absolutely rampant.
Yeah, yeah.
I've never seen anything like it. I think the only time something similar has happened was when the Beatles returned from America. And you just then, in one single sort of look at those pictures of that homecoming in 65, realise, you know, the importance of the work that Bill Shankly did, but also the importance of Liverpool Football Club in the city. It's just incredible. And then all these years later... you have a man on board in Jurgen Klopp that I think must have read his book, don't you think?
I'd like to think he has. I'd like to think he has. But I mean, I'm a firm believer that you should never be in anybody's shadow. And so sometimes, for example, if I was a manager of a football club, I don't think I'd want to know about what other people had done in the past.
But there's so many similarities in terms of seeing, you know, everyone's value, no matter what job you have in the club. Klopp has been so on board with that.
Yeah.
It's just like hearing your granddad talking, you know.
Yeah, obviously, you know, people will compare. They will compare because, you know, my granddad came in and he kind of revolutionised the club as it was. And so Jürgen came in and gave us that kind of lift and the return to the glory days that everybody had wanted for so long. I mean, so it's, you know, people are going to draw comparisons. They are. But Jürgen just seems a very genuinely, you know, whatever he does it because that's what he believes, I think. He's not, there's no sense from me that he's trying to imitate or anything like that anybody else. He's just authentically himself, which is great, which is why it works.
But I think he's inspired. By a certain man who made the people happy as well.
Liverpool Football Club is an inspiring place. I mean, you walk around and there is a lot to be inspired by. So, of course he must be inspired, yeah.
There's been so many football managers over the decades in all these different great football nations and on the international scene as well. And yet your granddad has been voted the top 10 best managers from ESPN and from French football. He's been voted the top 20 best managers in the world by World Soccer. How does that make you feel?
Well, you know, it's great that they acknowledge his, you know, his impact and rightly so. But, you know, he was such a huge, unique character. It is just very nice to have that recognised. I mean, if he were alive today, that would make everything worthwhile. I think the fact that he retired when he shouldn't have, and that would have left a bitter taste in his mouth. Perhaps he had wanted to get more involved with the club after retirement then, and it didn't work out. And if now he could see how much he still means to people, that would be, I mean, I think that would be the best thing ever for anyone, I think, that kind of recognition after all of these years. That's the perfect accolade, if I can use that word.
But you say he left at the wrong time and he was hoping to be involved with the club after. What happened and how did he feel?
I mean, lots of people have asked me this. I was quite young. Obviously, I was around 8 when he retired. I know people often say from the family that my nan had kind of been encouraging him to step down. She could see that he was tired. 15 years is a long time in that kind of job. It's very stressful. And maybe she could see it was beginning to take a toll on his health. And I think, so, I mean, there are lots of different possibilities. I don't know the exact reason why. Some people said that he was a bit concerned about money, and other people have said it was that he wanted to go when he was at the peak of his career and he didn't want anybody to remember him as a, you know, yeah, he had some glory years, but now he's on the way down. I mean, all of those could have all, maybe there wasn't one reason, maybe there were a lot of reasons that came into play and he decided that that was the right time. I think it's probably a combination.
But do you think he regretted it, though? Because didn't want to leave Melbourne Wood. He still kept coming.
No. He definitely regretted it.
Yeah.
100%. 100%.
Because football was his life.
Yeah, exactly. That was, I can say with all certainty that he did regret that. And the remainder of his life was kind of spent trying to, you know, regain some of his that connection with football, with football people. I mean, yeah, I imagine that was a lonely period in some ways for him, and a difficult one.
And he was more invited to other clubs than really to Liverpool for a period. Do you think Paisley and Liverpool needed a bit of a distance because he was such a charismatic leader that it wasn't really room for him when they were trying to sort of move on?
Yeah, I mean, all the players will tell you that they all called him boss after he left. And so here you've got Bob, who's trying to, obviously, to carry on, to do the job. And yet you've got my granddad coming in and people saying boss. And that's not a good recipe. That's a recipe for disaster at some point. I mean, it's only logical. But I think he would have liked to have been perhaps, I don't know, maybe some position on the board or something, been offered something. That's what I feel, personally. I may be wrong, but I think some involvement with the club that would have meant that he could still go, still be there, still be a presence and not be a threat would have been, a perfect recognition.
Let's talk a little bit about all these quotes, because you said he wasn't really a man of many words, which surprises me in a way, because the guy who took over, Paisley, was certainly not a man of many words, and he wasn't very good at putting them together, the boys say. But your granddad has so many quotes after him that has made him immortal. What are your favourites?
Oh, gosh. There are just too many. I mean, really, there are just too many. I can tell you one that I hate is that football is more important than life and death. I hate that quote.
Why?
Obviously, football isn't more important than life or death. You know, if somebody is ill or they die, that is more important than football. So I've never really liked that quote. I always cringe when people mention that quote, and I say, yeah, that's not one of his better ones. That's not one of his better ones. I mean, there are too many to choose from, really. I mean, all of them are great. He was, when I said before, like, he wasn't a great talker. I mean, he would come alive in front of the cameras when he was being interviewed because he knew he had to put on a performance. And if he was talking about football, he would have a lot to say to his friends or whatever, but in the house, he wasn't a great, with his family, he wasn't a great. He didn't have any real friends that you would say, oh, let's go out, have a drink, have a coffee. None of that he didn't have. It was all football-related acquaintances, all football-related people in his life. So, yeah.
One of my favourite quotes is, I don't know if I can remember it word by word, it was something about if Everton played in my backyard, I would pull... shut the curtains. But he did live very close to Everton's training ground.
He did. I mean, we literally lived maybe, I don't know, about 200, 300 steps from the ground. And we would often take the dog for a walk and go round to Everton. Obviously, you know, if they were playing in my backyard, I mean, Everton was not to the back of us, it was to the front. So he was just doing that for effect.
Yeah.
And there was a real respect for Everton, actually. And even though there was it was a friendly rivalry, it wasn't a bitter and mean or nasty rivalry. My granddad might say some stuff about Everton, but he always, always showed the utmost respect to Everton, the managers, the players, always. And when he died and at his funeral, there were lots and lots of blues lined up on the way to the church in their kits. So that was very emotional.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Karen, now that you are back from Greece,
yeah,
after living there almost, well, more than half your life,
yeah,
you're back in Liverpool, where it all started,
yes,
working with us at Hotel Tia. And we will be putting together tours with you so you can go into your granddad's footsteps. Tell us a little bit about what we're planning to make happen in the near future.
Well, obviously it will be sort of just, you know, visiting places where, you know, where he had tread before, the places that are associated with him. And obviously I will, you know, be able to tell people stories associated with various places, and people will be able to ask me questions about what it was like, you know, to grow up with him. And hopefully as well, at some point, we will be able to travel up to Glenbuch, see where it all started, because that is a pilgrimage, really. And it's one that, you know, I think it's an emotional one to see how he lived, where it started. Glenbuch is so important to the manager he became. I think it's important that we remember that place. It's important that it's not just forgotten.
And it's a small mining village in Scotland. And I can't wait to go there too. I am definitely signing up to that tour.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And we will be doing Shankly nights in Hotel T as well.
Yeah.
And bring some of the Shankly boys.
Yes.
With us.
Always a pleasure to talk to them and their memories. And they're such all such
gentlemen.
Great. Yeah, they're kind of a breed like that we don't see very, very often now. They're a special breed of player, of person. You know, they have their... They, and they're so eloquent, they speak so well, great speakers. So, and they've got lots of stories to tell. It was a different era, and it's nice to hear about that era. Now things are so clinical and cold, and everything is to do with technology. And these were men who played really hard and then partied really hard and smoked a lot and drank a lot, and they had lots of stories to tell. It wasn't just all routine. You trained, you did this. They had a more interesting, if I can say, experience, maybe.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. There are some stories.
There are some stories.
Last question to you, Karen. It's been absolutely amazing to honour the great man, Bill Shankly, with you in this LFC talk at Hotel Tia Shankly special. What is your fondest or funniest memory of your granddad?
Okay, funniest memory would probably one time when he drove out of the garage from Belfield Avenue, where my grandmother used to hang up the washing in the garage, and he would park the car, and one day he just drove off with a pair of my aunt's underwear, which was on the aerial sticking up, and he drove all the way down to Melwood with that flying from his car. And obviously, you know, he would not have seen the funny side of that at all. But my fondest memory, I think, of him is just when he would come to pick me up from school. It was nice because you got a little bit of, you know, time in the car, and he would chat with us and talk to us. And then he would always say, here's some money for you and stuff like that. When you're a teenager, that is just, that's what you need. Yeah, but I have so many, and going round to the house on Sundays and having our Sunday lunches with him, I will always remember them. They were special. Or if there was a special occasion, he would take us into town to the Lord Nelson Hotel, and we would have a really, really nice special meal there. Those are the kind of family memories. Staying at his house when I was little and being, you know, staying in the front room, the front bedroom. And he'd tell us stories at night about Glenbuch. And those are the stories that, those are my memories of him that I will never, ever forget.
Karen Gill, thank you so much for all your stories. And there will be loads more over the years to come.
There will, there will. Thank you very much for the podcast in his honour. It's that's really lovely thing to do.